Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Ah, yes. So good to be with you again as we explore the exciting worlds of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Today, our guest is Dr. Gary Hill. He's senior research scientist and chief astronomer for the McDonald Observatory at the University of Texas at Austin. Gary is the principal investigator of HETDEX, that's the Hobby Eberle Telescope Dark Energy Project, and they're trying to determine the nature of dark energy, that mysterious force that's causing the universe's expansion to speed up, it seems, almost endlessly. Dark energy is considered one of the pressing questions in science of today. And the Big Bang. They're looking way back with these telescopes to the earlier time to creation, and we're going to talk to Gary about creation and how we were formed. All that coming up in the second half hour, and of course we'll visit the Den of Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and at the end of the program, listener comments of the Voice of Reason. And now to today's guest.
Stand by.
And now to our program. Well, today we have Dr. Gary Hill. He's senior research scientist and chief astronomer at the McDonald Observatory, the University of Texas at Austin, of course. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it is so good. I'm glad that you could be with us. You're the principal investigator of HETDEX. That's the Hobby Eberle Telescope Dark Energy Project. Is that correct?
Yes. It is a fairly large project that we have ongoing at the University of Texas that is aimed at trying to understand the mysteries of dark energy.
Now, dark energy, dark matter, and all that is so confusing to many of us. We just plain don't understand exactly what it is you're talking about because no one's been able to really quantify it. Can you tell us what are you talking about, this dark energy?
Well, actually, I must say I wish I knew. I would say that it is really one of the biggest mysteries in all of science right now. And we hope that by trying to understand it better, we'll really be getting at some of the fundamental questions in physics and astronomy. So basically, what dark energy is a name that we've given to the phenomenon of the accelerating universe. About a decade ago, two groups went out to try to measure how much all the matter in the universe was decelerating in the universe just by all the gravity pulling on the matter and then essentially slowing down the expansion from the Big Bang. But then, in fact, they found out that they had an opposite sign, that the universe was actually accelerating and something was pushing back against the force of gravity. And we call this dark energy. It's dark because we can't observe it directly. And energy because it essentially has the properties of energy. It kind of pushes, counteracts the pull of gravity.
How do you know it exists?
Well, that's really something that has, in the last decade, has come first some early hints, but we essentially have a very detailed measurement, several of them, that show that the universe, instead of sort of coasting along in its expansion, has actually been accelerating. So the measurements that have been made have actually used supernovae, which are exploding stars in other galaxies, which act kind of like standard candles. We know how luminous they are when they explode. So the more distant they are, we know precisely from their brightness how far away they are. And those measurements showed that, in fact, over the last third of the age of the universe. The universe has been really accelerating and getting bigger at a much more rapid rate than it should have been without this thing we call dark energy. So we don't really know what it can be. There are several possibilities. One of them is that there is kind of a vacuum energy of space, a little analogous to the old 19th century idea of ether. Basically that just says that a volume of space has a certain amount of energy associated with it, and that energy essentially buoys up the universe against the pull of gravity trying to slow it down. And another possibility, though, is that there is a type of particle that that may well evolve through time that is causing it, that we just don't know about yet. And the third possibility is that, in fact, we don't understand the laws of gravity well enough, and that on very large scales, it's actually a lot weaker than we actually would get from extrapolating Newton's laws out to very, very great distances. So if any of these things turn out to be what dark energy is, they kind of go fundamentally to basic physics. It may well give us finally a theory of gravity if we can understand what's happening, for instance. So we know that there is gravity, and we've got a good parameterization of it, but we don't know why there is gravity. That's an example.
Okay, now, are we to then believe that the universe is endless, and this expansion of the universe will go on and on and on and on and on and on and on?
Yes, and with a few billion more anons. Yes. It's definitely the case. About when I first started doing astronomy 25 years ago, it was still an open question as to whether the universe was what we call closed, in the sense that there was enough matter in it to actually cause the expansion to eventually stop due to the gravitational attraction of all the matter, and then kind of implode back on itself over billions of years. And in fact, that was one of the measurements that essentially was being done when we discovered dark energy. So it turns out that the dark energy is of such a magnitude, it accounts for 70% of the entire sort of mass energy budget of the universe. It's dominating the dynamics right now, and so not only will the universe go expand forever, it'll accelerate forever. And there are some thoughts that if dark energy, say, gets stronger and stronger through time, that eventually it'll pull apart all of the stars and the galaxies and even the atoms. But that's a real extrapolation based on no information.
So what you're telling us is dark energy accounts for 70% of the makeup of the universe. Did I hear you right?
That is correct. And about another 25% or so is dark matter, which we're sure exists because we can see it gravitationally, but we haven't yet observed it. The Large Hadron Collider at CERN that's beginning to come online now may well create dark matter particles for the first time, which will be a huge breakthrough. But if you add all of that together, what's left is the sort of 4% of what we call baryonic matter, the matter that we're made of, that actually is a very small minority of what's in the universe. So what we really understand about matter and particles and fundamental physics in the universe is really only a small fraction of what's there. It's actually a little embarrassing, you might say, but it's a very exciting moment in the history of science, because we've got a major discrepancy between what we understand and what we're being faced with, what the universe is telling us. And so it's one of those pivotal moments where there's going to be some important breakthroughs from this. We just can't tell what.
Okay, I want to delve a little deeper into that, but right now we're saying dark energy is expanding the universe, but dark matter is somewhat similar but yet different. Can you explain the difference between the two?
Sure. Well, dark matter has actually been known for the best part of 50 years. Essentially matter which we can see by its gravitational attraction to things we can see, stars and galaxies, but we can't actually observe it directly. So it's needed essentially to hold galaxies together. The stars in the outer parts of spiral galaxies like our own are moving too fast to be held in an orbit by the amount of matter that we can actually see, the luminous matter, the stars and the dust and the gas in the galaxies. So we need this hidden dark matter component to actually explain that. Similarly, in big clusters of galaxies where you may have 1,000 galaxies all buzzing around each other around a common center of gravity, they couldn't possibly move as fast as they do without there being a lot of dark matter in those clusters to sort of hold it all together. So we know it's there for sure, and it's just that we don't yet know exactly what it is. So it's a type of fundamental particle that weakly interacts with itself and with normal matter, except for by gravity.
Okay, so it kind of pulls and absorbs where dark energy expands.
Yeah? Yes, exactly. It's really a fight between the two. And essentially over the last third of the age of the universe, the dark energy has won out. And that's fairly easy to understand, because as the galaxies in the universe move further and further apart due to the expansion from the Big Bang, the gravity between them gets weaker and weaker, Newton's laws. However, the volume between them, with the amount of dark energy between any two galaxies, actually goes up with time. So there's a point about a third of the age of the universe ago where essentially the dark energy began to dominate. So essentially the universe kind of coasted along. The gravity from the dark matter was beginning to sort of slow it down a bit, but the main thing was that the dark energy took over and is now dominating. So essentially it's a tug of war, and dark energy has won.
And at one time, the theory of the Big Bang was kind of a discounted, but it's commonly accepted theory now. Is that right?
Oh yes, absolutely. It was sort of on the time frame about 50 years ago. There were two competing theories. I mean, we knew from the early part of the 20th century, from the work of Edwin Hubble, that the universe was expanding. And there were two theories. One was the steady state theory that said that the universe looked the same through all time, but as it expanded, new galaxies would form in the voids between them, the other galaxies. And then there was the Big Bang theory that basically said that the universe started in a sort of a singularity, expanded from there, and that as a result, galaxies would get further and further apart through time, and as a result, the universe would be seen to evolve when we look back in time. Unfortunately, astronomers are able to look back in time because of the finite speed of light. So when we talk about distances, we talk in light years, and for instance, our experiment, when we get to it, we're talking about observing the universe as it was 10 to 11 billion light years away. In other words, we're looking at light that set out 10 to 11 billion years ago. So we can see the universe as it was back then. So this controversy between the steady state theory and the Big Bang theory was resolved by two major things. The first was actually the detection by Penzias and Wilson at Bell Labs of the relic of the Big Bang, the fireball of the Big Bang, which is called the cosmic microwave background radiation. And so that actually demonstrated that there had to have been this early hot phase. That was really very, very important, and they got the Nobel Prize for that. But the other piece of information was coming around the same time was that people found that active radio galaxies, these are galaxies with black holes in the center that give out radio jets, they were actually way more common in the past than they are now. And so those two pieces of information basically put the nails in the coffin of the steady state theory. So not only is the Big Bang theory well accepted, it's really been tested in immense detail subsequently, and we're really in a state now where we're doing precision measurements, such as these measurements of dark energy, to understand what it is, and they're all basically in the framework of the Big Bang theory.
And of course, as you mentioned, the things that you're observing occurred millions and millions of years ago. We see these photographs by the Hubble telescope, and we have to realize that isn't happening today. That's something that happened a whole long time ago. When do we get more current information?
Well, actually, the beauty of it is that the things nearby are the things that you're seeing really at your own epoch. The work I do in observational cosmology, we really rely on this ability to look way, way back in time. And we have to assume that we're seeing a fair sample of the universe at any given look back time, but we're observing such huge volumes of space that I think that's a fair assumption. So basically, you get to see the history of galaxies like our own by sort of looking back in time and looking at the galaxies there and seeing how their properties relate to, say, us. In our experiment, we're actually going to find about a million galaxies at this great distance away, 10 billion light years away. And those are actually the they're fairly small galaxies, but they're forming stars vigorously, and they actually will be, they are the precursors of galaxies like our own spiral Milky Way. They kind of join together through gravitational attraction and form bigger and bigger galaxies. So we're able to, we're not just doing an experiment on dark energy, but we're looking at the precursors of our own Milky Way, in a way.
Well, a couple of years ago, with a lot of excitement, you introduced a new instrument called the VIRUS, a Visible Integral Field Replicable Unit Spectrograph, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And can you tell me now, with all the excitement and the introduction of that new instrument, where have we come since then? What has it revealed?
Ah, right, right. Well, actually, VIRUS is an acronym that's actually had a few different word structures associated with it. But the idea of VIRUS is that rather than build one very large, very expensive instrument where most of your effort actually and money goes into the engineering to make sure it's right, instead you break the problem up into hundreds of smaller spectrographs. And when we say spectrographs, what we're doing is we're analyzing the light that we receive from the universe and spreading it out into a spectrum. And that allows us to find out things like the chemical composition of the stars or the galaxy that we're looking at, how fast it's moving away from us, which because of the expansion of the universe, we can actually relate to its distance, and also its internal dynamics and a lot of other interesting information. So while you see beautiful pictures from Hubble Space Telescope, you often need to go back and follow up and pick apart these objects in their spectra and actually understand much more physically what's going on. So a spectrograph is quite a complicated instrument, but by breaking it up into lots of smaller ones, that's where the replicable part of VIRUS comes in. We actually can drive down all of the engineering costs. And essentially, it's the, sort of the Henry Ford approach of mass production applied to optical astronomy for the first time. So the idea of the acronym is really that we hope that the VIRUS idea will sort of spread uncontrollably throughout astronomy, hopefully not in a negative way.
And you had to call it a virus. I mean, you just had to do that, right?
I had to do that, yeah. And the idea is sort of a bit of over a decade old, but it really turned into reality when we were talking about the possibility of attacking the question of dark energy with our very large Hobby Edley telescope in West Texas, which is a 10-meter-class telescope, and how we might be able to augment its instrumentation to be able to do enormously large surveys of the sky. In order to attack dark energy, we need to be able to survey the sky about 10 times faster than we currently can. We need a big telescope for that. But you also need an instrument that can analyze the light you're getting. And the only way we could see to really multiply up our ability to look at the sky rapidly was to just multiply up the number of spectrographs. And by using fiber optics to take the light from the telescope to these spectrographs, we're actually able to offload the weight of them and come up with a very, very cost-effective way of building a very, very powerful instrument. The other nice thing was that, so this full VIRUS instrument that we're going to actually be deploying in about a year and a half on the Hobby Edley telescope, so it doesn't quite exist yet, but what we have is a prototype that we've been using for the past 3 years on our smaller 107-inch telescope at McDonald, the Smith's Reflector. And that was basically built to prove all of the concept. We were able to prove all the engineering, that the optics do what they have to do, that we are actually getting the data that we require for the HETDEX project, ultimately. And that was very successful and has actually been a very powerful instrument in its own right on a relatively small telescope and really revitalized that telescope, in fact. So that meant we could really test all of our engineering, all of our software, and all of our concepts ahead of time. And now we're actually about to enter production, and we will be building essentially at least 150 channels for VIRUS spectrographs in the ultimate instrument that we deploy in about a year and a half.
So a year and a half from now, you're going to have new power, and what do you expect will come of that, and what sort of results, and how soon?
Right, right. Well. So the HETDEX project has an observing period of 3 years once we get on the sky. And what we will do in 3 years is survey an area of a bit over 400 square degrees, which is about 2,000 times the area of the sun, of the moon, not the sun, and it's going to be up in the north around where the Big Dipper is. So this is quite a large area of sky, in fact, because we're going to be looking very far away, we're actually going to be finding galaxies in this volume of space that, as I said, were about 10 or 11 billion light years back. As a result of that, we're surveying a very, very large volume of space, in fact, the largest volume ever surveyed. And we're doing it at this large look-back time. So we're going to be able to essentially map out the positions of a million galaxies in this very large volume, essentially just making a very, very large map. Humans have always liked doing cartography, and this is sort of the next step, you might say. And from this map, we're actually going to be able to watch the universe expand. There are patterns imprinted on the galaxy distribution that actually have certain scales that are preferred. And we can actually, through analyzing the positions of all of these million galaxies, we can actually pull those scales out and see exactly how big they appear on the sky, sort of as a function of time. And so we can basically have a standard yardstick embedded in the universe that we just watch expand. And this allows us to measure the expansion rate of the universe way back in time with percent level precision. And that's what we need to actually unravel whether dark energy has actually stayed the same through time, or if it actually was more stronger in the past, or even maybe weaker. It also allows us to look at how gravity pulled all of these galaxies together into these structures. And if we need to modify gravity to explain dark energy, we will see that as a signature in the observations as well. So we get to kind of test all of these possibilities that have been mooted for dark energy in a rather unique way back in time, and see if anything has changed through time.
You'll actually be able to see the universe expanding. And, of course, what you're going to be seeing is the universe expanding millions of years ago. So whatever the universe has expanded to at this particular time, we really won't know, will we?
Right. Well, right now we have some pretty strong predictions based on our current knowledge of the dark energy and the dark matter and the Big Bang. And we will be comparing what we see with those predictions. And in essence, that allows us to refine those predictions significantly, because the predictions are based on dark energy staying the same through time, based on our current measurements of it. It could easily have been stronger in the past. In fact, we're going into this without any real preconceptions. And in a sense, we're looking at this as a pure piece of experimental science. And we expect to get such a precise measurement that all the theories will have to refer to this as part of their testing. We're currently actually one of three projects going forward, and the other two, the Dark Energy Survey and the Baryonic Acoustic Oscillation Survey, BOSS, are actually both focusing on the much more recent universe and what dark energy was doing there and refining those measurements. And so essentially between the three experiments, we cover anchoring sort of the what dark energy is doing today against how it has evolved from a Hetfield experiment. And that lever arm that we provide gives us a huge amount of new information on what dark energy might do.
What surprises, if I were to ask you this week, if you get any surprises, or any this month, you get any surprise? What surprises are we talking about?
Surprises. Well, actually, you know, so this, as I said, this virus plus the upgraded Hobby Everly telescope surveys the sky 10 times faster than anything else, but it actually has another feature. What it does is it actually puts 33,000 fibers onto the sky simultaneously, and we don't pre-select what we look at. Essentially, we take snapshots of the sky, and we get a spectrum of anything that falls on one of the fibers. And as a result, we actually are looking at the universe in a brand new way. This is essentially a spectroscopic look at the universe without any pre-selection.
Well, I've been given the cue. We have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Imogene Faye. Of course, America has boundless faith in her young people. She proves it by the size of the public debt she expects them to pay off.